둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here for checking out the episode. You know what to do. Hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. A new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, three a week, to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover those new ones. You can grab us anywhere you get your podcast from. That's Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please give the series a rating. Leave a review as well. Those always help out so much. We've had some great guests on lately, including Weird Al Yankovic, who is just here. Samantha Morton, she's starring in The Serpent Queen and has a new album, Daffodils and Dirt. We talked to the cast of Women of Blue. That's playing now on Apple TV+. Adam Duritz of Counting Crows. Reggie Watts, the comedian, has a new special called Nevermind. Ryan Tedder of One Republic. Derek Whibley of Sum 41. Juliana Hatfield, Victoria Justice, Minnie Driver, and Tammy Stronach, the childlike empress from The Neverending Story, back with her first movie in 40 years called Man and Witch. Just an example of what you can get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's a rewind episode. We're turning the clocks back just to 2021 and 2020. A pair of interviews with David Duchovny, where we got to catch up with the X-Files legend to talk about being inspired by artists like Neil Young and Paul McCartney for his album Gestureland. We talked about his fourth novel, Truly Like Lightning, and playing socially progressive characters throughout his career. That includes turns in shows like Twin Peaks, It's Gary Shandling's Show, and Red Shoe Diaries, and of course the X-Files. All that and more as we turn the clocks back. Two interviews, 2020 and 2021. It's Kyle Meredith, a special rewind episode with David Duchovny.
Hi. Yes, for real. We talked about it in the abstract last time, didn't we?
That's right. You just released the single Laying on the Tracks during that election season that seems sort of like a million years ago and not so long ago at all. So.
Amazing. I think time has officially changed its nature in the last few years. So I think somebody has to call Einstein and figure it out.
Right. It's a new equation. That's true. But of course, in that conversation, we were talking about this record that you'd been working on called Gestureland. It's here now. I'm such a fan of so many of the songs on record right here. Let's start out with the newest single too, because you get this one out here with Nights Are Harder. Nights Are Harder These Days. I don't know if you did the whole thing right there. Just this massive guitar sound. Like when I first heard it, I was like, oh, there's some Neil Young stuff.
Yeah.
Going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, I wrote that song and then, I didn't write that riff, which I love. And, Pat McCusker and I, the guitarist in the band, we were just talking about, you know, touchstones for the sound. And I was like Neil Young and Crazy Horse and Zuma and like Cortez the Killer is one of my favorite songs of all time. You know, nothing like Nights Are Harder, but that kind of just a guitar, just that kind of muddy, fuzzy guitar. And then he came up with that riff and I was like, yeah, let's just pin the song on that and let's just drive it forward, you know?
Yeah, no, you definitely, that sound was nailed. In fact, after I got done listening to the record, I had to immediately put on a Neil Young record. I put on Mirror Ball and just played that one all the way through. Like,
yeah, like You Are Like a Hurricane or Cinnamon Girl, even. I just these classic earworm type riffs that Neil Young was doing back in the 70s. And I'm really interested in those riffs, like Start Me Up or whatever, just like, I love like riffology. I'd like to learn a course. Like, what is it about certain riffs that are just get in there? And, you know, certainly, I don't know how to do them or I haven't written them, but, you know, Pat's come up with a couple that I really like. And, that's one of them.
It's the time where the guitar really gets to take over, the melody parts. Like, I talked to some guitarists who, of course, been at it for decades and where in their younger days that seemed to be the thing. They were all about the riffs, and for some reason it seems like a lot of guitarists as they get older will switch over more to chords. And I know there's a lot more you can do with chords, especially when you get into the mathematics and the jazz, the whole thing, but
yeah,
but man, you're right, when you get a good riff, something you can sing along to, you know, those are the perfect ones.
Yeah, and there's a certain kind of there's also space within the riff, you know. It's not like you know, you think of like great AC/DC riffs, there's air in them, you know? It's not just like a driving riff. And there's something about the, I don't know, like you get inside it, like you get inside that riff. And this is one too, like Pat, like, you know, it's like boom, boom, and then there's like a little air, and then it's like back, and it's, you know, if you watch him play it, it's like, it's also the strumming pattern is cool because he's like, he's hitting the chord from the bottom up, you know, and it's just a slightly different chord that way. You know, it's just, to me, it works. So, yeah. You know, it's cool when it does.
Well, and I should do the compliments to what you're also doing there with the lyrics too, because you've got what every songwriter, I think a lot of songwriters at least want, and it's that turn of phrase, you know, like the old country singers were so good at that.
Yeah.
You know, Nights Are Harder These Days. I mean, that's right. The flip right there. Yeah. And I don't know, is that something you actually seek out when you're looking for lyrics or something like this, or, you know, like everything else, is that just something that kind of comes when it comes?
Comes when it comes. I recognize it when it does. Like Hard Day's Night, obviously, is the memory for me. You know, it's like, oh, that's, you know, kind of short circuits you a little bit, you know, in a good way. And that's, I think that's what a good riff / lyrical riff does. You know, it's just like turn something upside down. And I don't know when that phrase came to me, but I recognized immediately that I could write a song around that idea, you know.
Does it, at least the way I'm hearing it, I'm asking this question, does it sort of pick up where we left off with Lay It on the Tracks?
Yeah, in a way, it's written around that same time. But, you know, whereas Lay It on the Tracks, you know, I kind of put it out there as a political song, but it's also a personal song. I mean, if you look at the lyrics, it's like, the singer's trying to take responsibility for some of this stuff. It's not just like, oh, there's that bad guy there. It's also like the part of me that needed love that put me in certain places and made me do certain things that weren't kind. The part of me that turned away. It's not the part about what's out there. It's the part inside me. The part of me that turned away, I had to turn around, you know, because your pain is my suffering. You know, it's like, I can't look away. If I look away, I'm guilty, you know? So to me, yeah, I kind of pinned it out there as a protest song. Cause of course it name checked the president, but in a way, but you know, to me it was never just like, oh, bad guy there. It was also like, hey, not great guy here. And Nights Are Harder you know, it kind of tells a story about a friend who kills himself, and then it's about the singer who's being visited by people that he's wronged, and then it's just like the chorus would be just like, generally nights are harder these days, I think, for everybody. And that's the way it kind of felt at the time. But again, it's like trying to, in the song, reach out in some universal way. Nights are harder for all of us these days, but also take some responsibility and also have some empathy for someone who may have, checked out permanently because of these kinds of feelings.
I mean, all the best songs right there, the ones that speak on, you know, those multi-levels. I mean, of course, how I was hearing it, you know, was not exactly how you were writing it. And, I think you were saying that in the press sheet or the bio or something about when you said, you know, these aren't about me. These are about you in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a handful of the songs on here I was able to really apply.
I try, you know, yeah. That's like my, you know, I'm not like trying to write breadcrumb songs that are going to lead you to some kind of confession or, you know, some kind of a celebrity, you know, real life event or whatever. I'm really not interested in that kind of a song. My enterprise is always like, all right, I'm feeling these things. I'm not the only one, but maybe if I can phrase them in a certain memorable way, maybe it can release something. Maybe I can have a bridge. Maybe we can get people to sing along because it means something, you know, to them. And if I get too specific, that's not going to happen, because I do love the song "David Duchovny, Why Don't You Love Me" by Bree Sharp, but I think it's got a limited reach, you know. So it's like that. It's like I don't want to limit it. I want it to expand out.
And we'll be right back right after this.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with David Duchovny.
One of the best examples on this subject that I always think of is the U2 song Pride. You know, here you have one of the most universal choruses of all time, you know, Pride in the Name of Love. Yeah. And then when you get to the verses, I mean, talk about though getting specific, you know, Monday morning, April 4th, you know, I mean, he's right down to the date and the spot and everything. And I know we're talking about, you know, historical context here in that song and everything, but to kind of be able to play around with that, to be able to do something that you know is very specific and personal to you, but still have that spot, like that's a really hard trick to pull off as a songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. That's such a great song. And, you know, what he's doing there is exactly what you say in the verses, but in the chorus, you really get the feeling he's singing about himself. You know, it's about a one man, you know, the verses are all about like universal love for mankind and people that have sacrificed and been sacrificed because of love like that. Agape, I guess, you know, like the love, not sexual love, not possessive love. But somehow in the choruses, that kind of comes in. It's like one man, you know, it's one man's love there, you know, one man. And that's a neat trick. You know, that's hard to do. You know, I was thinking about, I think when we were talking about laying on the tracks, I was always thinking about other protest songs, like For What It's Worth, you know, that song, which is also very specific. I mean, he's talking about something that happened in LA, you're carrying signs over there, whatever. You don't need to know, because the chorus is just, it just breaks out of those specifics somehow. And that's why that song is in every movie you ever see. You know, it's like somehow they were able, or Ohio, you know.
Oh, to me, I was thinking about Ohio when you were saying that. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, Ohio, I think the trick in Ohio is the riff. I mean, it's just, absolutely. And that's Neil Young again. So that's just like, I think they could have put any words on that and that would have worked. But the fact that it is a protest song so specifically about one day, one incident, and yet it's able to branch out, you know, it's just a magic trick. Yeah.
Well, while we're giving praise to Neil Young, I, for the quick second here, at the end of Cinnamon Girl, he throws in that extra riff. For my entire life that I've known that song, I've been like low-key upset that he wasted that riff, because that's such a cool little throwaway thing he's doing that I was like, you could have done a whole song off of that one, man.
Yeah, I feel that way about Paul McCartney all the time. Like he has like five songs in one song, you know. Sometimes it's almost like he overburdens the song with, he's such a melodic genius that he doesn't know how good it all is and that it's worthy of a whole song. But like, what's that song, We're So Sorry, Uncle Albert? It's got three different sing-along melodies in it, and each one of those is a song, and somehow the song doesn't work as well because it's too good, you know, there's too many good things in it. And I understand your feelings about that riff. I wonder what Neil Young would say about that. I've also felt that, you know, Don't Fear the Reaper is one of my favorite. It's not really a riff, it's more like a picking riff, you know, that. But the bridge, I always hated the bridge, you know, where it goes, and it's just because it's so melodic and haunting, and then it just smacks you in the face for like eight bars. And I go back and forth between like loving it because it's like it lulls you into this dream and then it smacks you right out of it, or just like, oh, why that's a different song, you know.
There's the 90s horror film Scream. Yeah. It was Scream 1 or Scream 2, I don't remember, but there's an acoustic version that somebody did. It's just a Gus, I don't know who it was, I've never seen that artist again, but Gus did an acoustic version. There's no bridge and it's slowed down. It's just acoustic. It's such a good version of that song if you're a
right. I mean, it's, well, I mean, then there's the SNL skit that
kind of, sure, right
just more cowbell. I love the cowbell. In fact, I say cowbell sometimes. I say I need a cowbell in the song. I'm not sure they listen to me. I know they put it on Last First Time. There's a cowbell on that, but I love a good cowbell song. And Mind of Winter, I was like, I want to separate. There's like a verse and there's like two pre-choruses. It's a strange little song. So the verse is pretty much just drums and me. And then there's the first pre-chorus where another instrument accompanies me. And then there's the second pre-chorus that originally was just like the first pre-chorus. And I was like, we got to like differentiate. Let's just put the hand claps in there. So we just added some hand claps and I was like, okay, now I'm satisfied.
It gets that head bob going. I know what you're talking about in that song. And let me say, you know, yeah, bringing that attention back to the gesture land here. So I think my favorite song on here is Everything is Noise.
Yeah.
To the point where I've now played that in the house, I don't know, two dozen times or something. My wife walked in, she goes, what is that? It's one of those moments, you know, the sound from another room. What is that song? it's David Duchovny's new song. It's Everything is Noise on the record. It's like, oh,
yeah,
that's a good one. That's a really good. It's like, yeah, that's what I'm thinking about putting in rotation here on FBK in Louisville. Like that's going in.
Nice.
Like it nice. Had a little bit, we were trying to figure it out. I was like, what does it remind you of? Because there's something there. Little bit of Belle and Sebastian, little bit of The National. She said that in there. I don't know what's going on, but you've made, as far as really somewhat simple pop songs go, like this, that's a perfect example right there.
Yeah, that was Keenan O'Meara in the band. That was brought, we wrote that one. And he kind of, that's the only song where I kind of laid off the lyrics. He wanted me to like, you know, change the lyrics or like make them whatever more something. And I was like, no, I want to like sing it this way, you know? And I just, that song, I love the sentiment of it. You know, it's kind of like, to unpack it, it's like every, it's fuck it, like everything's noise, like give me what you got. And then there's also kind of a beautiful resignation in it, which is like, I'm here, you know, like I'll withstand it. It's not I'm quitting. And then Keenan has this wonderful high voice. I mean, he's got an amazing voice and it's really high and it's not a falsetto. And he did that thing at the end with like those kind of choral circling ooze. And I was like, let's just have like 3 minutes of that. You know, they're like, no. I wanted to start the song with that because the start of that song was always a puzzle to figure out because it starts with it's singing. It's like, there's no intro. It's just, I was breaking through, you know, and I think Pat McCusker put like a little synthesizer pad on the front of it. And I was like, that feels cheap. You know, it's like, in a way, it's like sometimes when you do that, if a song starts hard, you want to give the listener just like a little heads up that a song's about to start rather than bang, here's the song. And so we were trying to figure out how do we start this song that's not like, holy shit, a song just started, you know? So I think we have this one like half a beat before it's like, boom, I was breaking through this, you know, it's like, and I just love the way it starts that way because there's almost no warning. I forget it was, when we did Stranger in the Sacred Heart, it starts with Pat, like this little pick riff that goes da 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 da, and it's high. And I was like, oh man, I jump every time that song starts because there's no warning. It's just like, ding, it's on me. So I was like, can we prepare the listener, you know? So I think we have the sticks. We're just like 1, 2, 3, 4.
Just enough to get in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. This was another one like that. It was like, I don't want people to have a heart attack, you know, like all of a sudden. But yeah, I love that song too. And I look forward to writing more with Keenan, you know, because it's definitely a different sensibility.
Just a great little pop song in that way. And I know we're running out of time here. Two things. Are you planning on touring this? I'm guessing that's coming up as well.
Hope so. Don't have anything specific because, you know, the world is still figuring it out. You know, I'd love to be out there right now, but obviously no. But yeah, that's the plan, you know. And the plan would be, you know, we really haven't done an American, like a full American tour. You know, nothing crazy, like months long kind of a thing, but would love to play more in America. We played East Coast, West Coast, but I love to play everything. And then we've played Europe a couple times and I'd like to go back there. But I really look forward to, you know, some of these songs I think are going to be just really fun to play live, like Nights Are Harder, like Laying on the Tracks, you know, just like Wall of Noise.
Well, I don't know how you fit a full 2 month, 3 month tour into the schedule that you've had for yourself lately. You know, I'll quickly point out, I know The Reservoir is out. The Bubble is on the way with Apatow. You've got Truly Like Lightning, I guess is eventually going to hit at some point.
Hope so. We haven't started, you know, we don't have the green light yet to shoot. You know, we're still in the development stage, but I'm optimistic and my heart is really set on that. I really want to make that show. So I'll be sorely disappointed if I can't. I feel like I'll be able to. We'll know pretty soon. And that would then dictate, you know, my right. touring schedule.
Well, I'm in it for all. And, you know, hearing how all of these cross over in some way, I'm always interested when any artist puts together this many different projects. And, you know, starting looking for like, ooh, is the book part of the album? Is the album part of the show? You know, do you find those crossover moments?
Well, Chris Carter was kind enough to have a cover done of Unsaid Undone, which is from the Hell or High Water album. And he put that on the X-Files. He had like a punk version of that on the X-Files. And I understood why it would be weird to have a voice that sounded like Mulder's singing on the soundtrack of the X-Files. So yeah, that would have been too meta for me anyway, but I did an episode of my friend Amanda Peet's show. It's coming on Netflix. It's called The Chair. And they I think they're going to use Mind of Winter in that, which is cool, really cool. And then, you know, I've always kind of fantasized about like placements in movies and stuff like that, that I wouldn't be in, that it would just be like a musical placement. But I do feel like if one layers too much of oneself, you know, fuck you. You know, it's like there are plenty of great songs that I could use on a Truly Like Lightning series without using my own.
Do whatever you want, man. It's your life. You know, it's your thing.
No, you're right. You're right. It is. It is. To quote song on the album, it's just playing at the same dream, right? None of this is real. It's just some dream we're all having, right? So why not?
Yeah, that's a great sentiment to wrap it up on right there too. David, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. Congrats on Gestureland. I'm so much enjoying what you're doing.
Likewise. Thank you.
And we'll be right back right after this. That's part one of this Rewind episode with David Duchovny. Now let's head back to 2020 for part two, Kyle Meredith with David Duchovny.
How are you?
So we're talking about new music from your land. Not quite the album yet, but we do have a new single, and that's called Laying on the Tracks. And this is leading to the album, though, right? The third LP?
Yeah, third album. We're calling it Gestureland. And I'm not sure exactly when it's coming out because everything's been thrown into disarray, obviously, because of COVID. And we were pretty much done with the bulk of it, almost 10 months ago, but you know, we had to record harmonies, background vocals, and other instrumentation, which has obviously taken quite a while. You know, I've been raring to share it for a long time, and I'm excited when it eventually come out.
I think that's just kind of the thing for everybody. I mean, you know, we're all like, eventually, sometime, maybe.
Most of the interviews you'll hear are like, oh yeah, I don't really remember what we're talking about. I did that 10 years ago. Right. It's coming out now? Oh, cool. Yeah, well, I hope you like it.
Well, you know, to get at least a little preview on the rest of the record, you have given it the album title, Gestureland. What exactly is that?
It's kind of just like I was trapped in my home like everybody this spring and summer. And I just was noticing, you know, that there's a kind of, not virtue signaling, but just signaling. Like there were all these signals going on, all these kinds of t-shirts and everything. And I was just like, well, that's all great. I'd like to make real change, you know, and stop just making gestures. So I'm hoping for real change. Now, putting out an album and hoping for real change is just a gesture, right? So I'm guilty as well, but I just had this experience of kind of almost a feeling like a drift and not even understanding some of the gestures that I was seeing, but being aware that they were gestures and feeling like we were living in a gesture land.
I don't know. I think I might argue your point a little bit there, that putting out an album is only a gesture, because I mean, with the idea of music, I know for a lot of songwriters, it is hoping for that connection, and that connection leads to real change. And maybe I'm missing your point a little bit, but I see it, this as being very active when you're putting out a record in you know, that you want to have to say something.
I agree. I mean, I guess, you know, people say, in the sense that people say, it's the gesture that counts, right? It's an attempt. It's an attempt to reach. And I guess in that sense, yes. I would rather live in a world where people were still at least making the gesture to touch one another or to reach one another or to sway or argue with one another, you know. I was just having a feeling of just being like drowning in so many different kinds of gestures over a certain period of time that I just got kind of scared, you know, almost as if like, you know, I didn't know the language anymore. It was like that.
Well, you get this definitely very poignant on this first single, this teaser track that we have called Lay It On The Tracks. And this is something, I mean, you have political songs. Maybe it's like Dylan or maybe it's like Rage Against the Machine. But I know that this was written earlier in the year, as I've read and everything. But at some point, you're going to have to figure out how the song, I don't know, for you, is it on your mind? Does it have to speak to right now? Or did you try to make it to where it's going to live beyond, you know, the election cycle?
Well, my intention is always to try and write something that's going to be timeless, so that it's going to be, I mean, my process, I guess, or just my instinct when I'm writing a lyric is to make it universal but vague, you know, in some way that can plug in for anybody, either whether it's the emotionality of a breakup or a love song, or, you know, vague political unrest, like in this song, you know, so that it's not just tied to a moment, but tied to a feeling.
Yeah, there's a line in there, and that's probably my favorite in it. There's a part of us that's always been at home in the blood.
Yeah.
And that part to me is not very vague, because that is saying something about our history. Like, you know, that's, I mean, the part of us that's always, I mean, it's not like this is a new situation, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
It is what I'm saying, but I'll tell you quite honestly that, and I know what I was thinking of when I wrote that line. I wasn't even writing that line about America. I you know, I read, like so many people, I read Sapiens like 5 or 6 years ago, which is like a history of Homo sapiens, of people, you know, on this planet. And it's a devastating kind of an account of our nature, you know, and the destruction and the violence that we brought throughout time. And I was kind of thinking about us as a species more than even us as Americans. So that just tells you the process of my songwriting is really, I'm sure I was thinking about America too, but like, I know in my mind that book so profoundly affected me in terms of our behavior as a species throughout all of human history. So that's kind of where I was at. So yeah, it was like that part of us has always been, you know, from the time we splintered off from some of the other primate DNAs, you know.
There is, I'd wondered, you know, going into this, I think we've all become even more political, and it's always been a big part of my life, the interest. I saw the picture you posted of, I think it was your mom, 90-year-old mom, waiting in the rain to vote. did you grow up, I mean, very political in that kind of nature? Was that always a part of your alls?
No, I would say that's probably the first time my mom has voted. Yeah, my mom is from Scotland. She's an immigrant. And, I don't believe really she's ever voted before. And she was just moved this time around to go on record as well. So I did not grow up in a political household. My mother was a school teacher and wasn't political. My father was political, but not, how do I explain it? I guess he's a liberal Democrat. You know, he wrote a play called The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, which was about the assassination of Kennedy. He was interested in less in the workings of politics and more in like social thought, I guess, cultural thought. So in that sense, I guess I grew up aware of great movements that might be happening in the country, but not in terms of like grassroots stuff, or even, you know, my father had a real healthy hatred for Nixon. I remember that, but he wasn't like enamored of the Kennedys either, you know, so he wasn't like a reflexive kind of a political follower. So, the kind of all consuming attention on politics is very new to me. And I can't say that I like it, but, you know, it's part of my life now that I wake up every morning and I look and see what the fuck happened yesterday, which is crazy because life used to not be a day-by-day proposition like that. Right. It was 4 years by 4 years, or a month by a month, or a year by a year, but it was certainly, now it's hourly. It's hourly. And it's not just all on Trump's doorstep. It has to do with the fact we have this technology, too, to be able to check in. But it's tough to have your own mind.
Well, so with, you know, what's left to hear from Gesturland, which is the entire record, Beyond Land on the Tracks,
yeah.
I mean, is there more of that on there? I mean, would you call this a political album? Does it still kind of take on everything?
Oh, let me get back to like a little bit about why Gesturland, because I haven't been asked that before because I haven't been talking about it. But I think also I was responding to kind of the way one is forced to communicate through Twitter and through social media, which is in symbols and signs and quick kind of pops.
and that it kind of precludes deep thinking in a way in favor of throwing out marks of affiliation. And I found that to be dangerous and unsettling. So I think that's more of where I was coming from. So what was that last question?
Well, I was asking if that, you know, if this song is really representative of the rest of the record. I mean, do you go further down that path?
I think less specifically. Like, I have a line, a stupid orange man in a cheap red hat. I mean, I can't get much more pointed than that. Well, that rhymes. I could have continued on. But I don't have lines like that. I don't have lines where you allegorically go, you know, this is about that or this is about something else. You know, there's a share of love songs or of, existential songs. I don't know what else to call them. I mean, it's like every time I write a song, it's like it's a different person writing that song. And it just kind of has the point of view of that guy who's me nominally in that moment. But there's less of a through line of like, oh, this is a 2020 group of songs that are addressing where our country is or the election or something like that.
So with three albums in, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I did read at one point, like, it's not like you've been writing songs all of your life. Like, this is still sort of what, like 10 years or something like this. Do you find, are you feeling like you're finding your voice? Because usually when you start, a lot of us, you know, whether you can hear it in the song or not, we're kind of imitating someone, but three albums in, I would think that you're really starting to find that.
Yeah, it's interesting because the guy that I work with, Brad Davidson, he's been working in the music business a long time, and he says you have your whole life to make your first album and then like 6 months to make your second, right? So it's, I think songwriting to me has come in a few separate bursts. The first one was the longest because I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know, I'd never written a song. So all of a sudden I started just writing songs, you know, and then there was a period after that I thought I should really continue to write songs, you know, because nobody was saying, you know, you must write songs, and I didn't have to write a song to eat or anything like that. So there was no external pressure on me to write a song, and there wasn't necessarily that much time. So I really had to at some point tell myself, now I've got to write some songs, because I won't write a song unless I write a song. like today I could probably write a song, but I probably won't, because I won't sit down and write a song. And that's kind of the way I do it. At first it was like, gotta write these songs. I'd never written any. God, they're all there. They're all waiting. And then it was like, yes. And I think you're right. I think what happens is like after that first batch comes through, that it's like more measured, more kind of like, well, who am I as a writer really? You know, what, I can relax a little bit because I'm not like, oh my God, it's happening. It's like, oh yes, it could be there. If I take some steps out to meet it, we could have a song. And usually I'm pretty good at knowing like when I have a song. And then at first I used to just try to complete it on my own, you know, because I wasn't recording. And then now it's more of a collaborative effort where, you know, I'll get my band involved earlier, so that it's more of a group effort.
Well, I'll compliment your sense of melody. It reminds me quite a lot. I was thinking last night of Jeff Tweedy, because
thank you.
It's It's not like you don't come in with this chorus that's just, you know, whatever, Rocket Man or something like that. You know, it's almost this subtle thing that you realize, like, oh my, you know, after you've heard it the second or third time, it's like, hey, wait a second, this is really catchy, you know, in there. I think that's a really good trick.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think part of it is probably, you know, limitations being, you know, my friend, you know, like I would never write the chorus to Rocket Man because I can't sing it. You know, I was like, so that might happen if I was with the band, and I'd say to Colin, who's got a far greater range than me, I'd say, I'm hearing it up here. You know, can you get there? You know, but if I'm sitting alone, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, I mean, I thank you. I think that I love melody. I mean, I've always loved a nice melody, and I certainly love Jeff Tweedy and guys like Petty. You know, just very kind of not straight ahead, but like, and simple is the wrong word too, but just like real rock and roll type catchy the first time you hear it. You know, it's nice to, it's not a complicated memory. You can kind of memorize it first time through, you know.
It's all in there. And I'll compliment you on that again. I know that's not the only thing you're working on. And when you talk about, you know, today you might not write a song, like, I'm not surprised in that, because I want to bring up a few of the outside of music things that you've got going on, right, too. Yeah. You've got another novel on the way, Truly Like Lightning.
Yeah, I got the galleys right here. Look at that.
It's beautiful.
It's a nice cover.
Beautiful. That's I think that's coming out in February, right?
Yeah.
February of this coming year. Now, I do find, like, of course, I don't have the book, so I'm going on, you know, what is out there so far. But I do find there seems like a connection, even when we listen to the song laying on the tracks versus kind of what you're getting at in the book, too, because I think the quote I got offline here, how we make sense of right and wrong in a world of extremes. This seems like further on down that path as we were talking about, you know, just the inundation that we've been faced with.
Well, it's fascinating to me if no one else on the planet, but I do feel like if you can speak universally enough or poetically enough, then your work has a chance to wait for its moment. Because, you know, ultimately, I don't think the moments that we have as humans are all that different from epic to epic, right? They're going to, you know, it's different dress, it's different time. We might look a little different, but, you know, love, hate, anger, revenge. I mean, it's all, it's not a huge smorgasbord of shit that we go through as humans, which I think is wonderful. And the artists are the ones that try to interpret that. So as you said, or as we were talking earlier, if you can kind of rise above the specifics of it and somehow encode the feeling in there, then all of a sudden it becomes appropriate in many different epics and situations. And what I found when I was pitching the novel as a television show this summer, and I was able to set it up at Showtime, not to get it on the air, but, you know, to develop it. And as we were pitching it, and this was during the lockdown of the summer, it is a story that I'd written the year before. So, you know, long before COVID was probably in existence in the humans. It's about a guy who takes his family out of society into the middle of the desert and kind of raises a compound there away from the world, you know, away from the modern world. He raises them kind of biblically, like in by the laws of the Old Testament and the Mormon Bible. And that took on a totally different light once COVID hit, which, you know, all of a sudden, you know, my agents were kind of teeing up this book, this show, as a response to COVID, you know, when in fact it's not at all a response to COVID. But I think the desire to run away, to make a utopia, to get away from the contamination either of brain viruses or real viruses is probably almost as old as the writings of the Book of Eden itself. You know,
it's a really interesting premise for a story too. I mean, you've made the character Mormon, which does give this story an opportunity to have the conflict, I guess, because there he is trying to raise this family, which of course is multiple wives and everything, and gets faced with an outsider. Again, I'm only
well, that's true.
Saying what I've read from the press sheet so far. So,
well, that's true, because, you know, it's it's a weird conversation to have, but, you know, clearly it's illegal to have multiple wives in this country. It's against the law. But if you look at Mormon history or Mormon founding, then it was more like the law that you should. And it's these questions of, and I think modern day Mormons have different feelings about it, but it's a question of what is custom, what is customary, and the difference between what is customary and what is right, what is customary and what is moral, what is customary and what is ethical, changes very drastically from civilization to civilization, from century to century. And that's kind of what the book is about as well, is kind of step back and look at my own relativism in a way. And what's my true morality, aside from my knee-jerk response to certain things that I'm seeing, that, and what's really coming from me as a human being when I watch something and I have this feeling, isn't that my morality, that my empathy coming out, or my outrage, or my being appalled? Isn't that like my natural morality, and shouldn't I somehow honor that rather than some customs that have come up in the last 100 years, 200 years, 500 years, whatever, different clothes? So that's kind of what it's about.
Do you find that you figured that part out as the story progresses, or do you go into the story trying to solve that riddle within yourself and then coming up with a plot that, you know, gives it the vehicle?
It's a really good question, because it's like a knot that I couldn't untie for you. I had no kind of overarching interest in Mormonism, aside from the fact that it is really the only religion that's in Christianity that's grown up on American soil, right? So it's like, it's quintessentially American, you could say. And then they had some precepts like polygamy and something else called blood atonement, which were very cool in terms of being able to be plot drivers for me. And that's really where I entered into that world, wanting to take those things out of it and use them in a story. And then, of course, I got kind of wrapped up in so many other things. But that was my original movement towards, okay, I got to learn about Mormonism and I got to learn about all these things because I want to hang a story that has to do with certain kind of customs that Mormons have developed over the years since Joseph Smith. So it's all kind of like, it's like, it just goes back, it kind of circles back on itself. And so I didn't know any of those things. I didn't, just like I didn't know I was writing a response to COVID before COVID happened, you know?
Right, right. Well, this all comes in the middle of, I guess, your acting career too, because it's been a few years and you kind of, I guess you actually did put the stop on it. You say, I'm going to stop this right now so I can work on the music, so I can work on the books and everything. Right. But we now have your first role in, I guess, 3 years, and that's with The Craft Legacy.
Yeah.
What was it like stepping away? First off, I mean, I know that's the easy question. What was it like stepping away for 3 years and actually being able to go, not right now?
Well, I mean, I have to say that in those 3 years, I tried a couple times to set up movies and television shows that got really close and then didn't happen. And they took up, so I was like working towards, to make a movie of the novel Bucky Fucking Dent, you know, and I think I probably would have shot it this summer if not for COVID. And I was constantly getting close with that. So I was kind of always like just about to do something, and then it didn't happen. And so I wish I could say that A, it was all my idea, and B, I didn't spend any time on it. You know, it takes almost more work to not get shit done than it takes to get shit done, honestly. So I was busy trying to do a couple of different things with creators and artists that I really love, you know, and just would get this closer. But having said that, you know, after like a year and a half of that, I probably thought I should take a year off. But then like after a year and a half of that, I was like, oh, that's been a while. Now I'm starting to get nervous. Like, oh, I should get out there, or what's it going to be like for me to act, you know, because I'd not gone, I did a lot of acting. I mean, I may not do that many different jobs because I've done a lot of television, long-running television, but a lot of acting. I'm used to it. I'm used to like acting a lot. So that was kind of cool to go back. I would say for 2 years, it probably been 2 years since I acted when I did The Craft. And I was nervous going back. I was like, you know, not so much do I know how to do this. It's more like, how do I want to do this now that I've had this like moment to like step back and go, yeah, I can do these other things that I like doing. And what is my approach now? You know, can I do it in a way that's less kind of self-seeking, or can it be better now that it's part of three things that I do rather than, you know, it's like that or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or have I forgotten how to memorize lines? You know, there's a lot of weird questions that first day. For me, that went away very quickly. But I guess the good news for me was that I realized that I really enjoy it. You know, I enjoyed working on the film. I enjoyed acting.
An unintended luxury.
Yeah.
Do you, with something like this that has a history, The Craft being a movie that existed in the 90s and now, you know, a sequel of sorts in a way, or a further story, whatever you want to call that. As an actor, do you treat that differently if something has a legacy, no pun intended with the title there?
Yeah.
Than if it was an original story?
Well, I guess I was lucky enough to know that my character in this movie did not exist in the previous one. So to be honest with you, I'd never seen the original, and I still haven't. I never saw it. I've never seen it. And in fact, somebody asked me, you know, what's your favorite line in the movie? And I said, I really like that line, you know, we are the weirdos. And they were like, well, that's from the original. I was like, oh, well, I knew that.
Of course. Yeah. It's got a great soundtrack, the original one. I could say that, you know, as I'm flanked by a couple of soundtracks that you've been a part of.
Zoe Lister-Jones, who I think did a great job with the movie, is a big music lover. Anyway, so she loves music. And I'm sure the soundtrack for this and whatever ensuing soundtracks come out of this are going to be great.
No, it's got a good legacy to go with there, the soundtracks. And I'll wrap it up on this too, because the one thing I notice about The Craft legacy is that, you know, it does speak to a new generation, and I'll just go ahead and, you know, say the Gen Z side of things. And as I look back on your career, not everybody has this as a part of it, but I thought you were sort of talking about a lot of this really early in your career and a lot of your roles. You know, you played, you had a transgender role in the early years. I feel like even, you know, Red Shoe Diaries to a point, you know, was doing a little bit of that in a very different way, but
yeah.
I don't know. Do you find that you're able to connect to it in that sense easier than, you know, other folks have been?
I think I have a real appreciation for like a transgressive point of view or a subversive point of view. So even something like Red Shoe Diaries, it's subversive in a way. I can't tell you how. I'd have to really go back and look at it.
Sure, sure.
Certainly X-Files is subversive, even though it's a mainstream, you know, network television. Californication, in a way, I think is subversive. You go back to Twin Peaks, and I don't think she's transgender. I think Denise Bryson is a transvestite. I could be wrong. It's been a long time. But yeah. It was very interesting doing that role again in 2017, I think, is when I did it, and reading some stuff about how, okay, he's allowed to do it because he did it before, but if we were casting that role now, we'd have to cast it this certain way. That was interesting. So I think I just, you know, I just respond to kind of outsiders in a way, even though, you know, right now I'm the ultimate insider, being, you know, male, white, my age, you know, but that's just the way I'm drawn, like Jessica Rabbit, you know, on the inside I feel transgressive.
Well, I'll even bring up, you know, the great moments on the Gary Shandling show. I mean, Here you are saying, no, I'm not gay, but I wish I was, because I think that's your actual line there, because.
That kind of spawned a million bromance jokes in a way. That was kind of maybe the first, one of the first times that kind of a thing. I would say that's, I would be comfortable like walking into that area and trying to act in it and trying to figure out what it is. Yeah.
Well, David, I certainly do love what you do with everything. And I'll bring up the most recent stuff. The Craft Legacy is out, Truly Like Lightning, February of 2021, and Gestureland at some point. Thank you so much for talking about all this today. It's been so much fun and a real pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thank you.
And of course, my thanks to David and to you for checking out the episode. Please do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week, a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Spotify, at Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith with. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're here as well. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You'll get 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. In fact, one of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from artists like Wilson Pickett, Arrested Development, Blind Pilot, Garbage, No Doubt, Liz Phair, The Smiths, Ramones, Nirvana, Casey Musgraves, Chris Cornell, The Pixies, Alison Krauss, Alice Merton, Tori Amos, Talking Heads, The Connells, Pearl Jam, Childish Gambino, and my interview with Josh Radnor of How I Met Your Mother and Fleischman Is in Trouble fame. Again, just an example of what you can hear weeknights starting at 6 p.m. Eastern when you tune in at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone. Up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.